You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman.
Epidemiologists study sickness and disease, the ways they spread and how we can combat them. It's all in the interest of protecting public health. And there have been increasing calls to treat gun violence this way as a public health crisis. 2 days ago, a gunman at a Texas mall killed at least 8 people and injured more. After a mass shooting in Atlanta last week, HHS Secretary Javier Becerra said, quote, "There is no escaping that gun violence is tearing the American family apart and has become a public health crisis." Now more epidemiologists will be studying the many health impacts of gun violence. For the first time ever, the Springer Handbook of Epidemiology has added gun violence to its pages. How does looking at gun violence as a disease change the way we view it? I spoke with two of the authors of the inaugural chapter. Ali Rohani is a professor, and Julia Schleimer is a PhD candidate at the University of Washington's Department of Epidemiology. And just a heads up, our conversation focuses heavily on gun violence and suicide. I started by asking my guests how endemic the problem of gun violence is worldwide.
So we start with covering this very broadly at the global level, to not just focus on the United States. The handbook is a global book. It's an international book written by many people from around the world. It's not a US or American book. So it has wide readership around the world. About 250,000 people die each year due to firearm-related injury. 250,000 people. In the United States, about 45 to 50,000 people die each year. So a fair share of those deaths are actually here in the United States. But there are several other countries around the world, especially countries in Latin America, that have a really high burden of gun violence mortality. This is a problem that is very much clustered in several countries. It's not something that is endemic around the world. There are certain countries, about 10 or 12, that have the highest burden of gun violence-related mortality. We obviously are one of those countries. And the reason for why this is so high in certain countries is really, really complex and multifactorial. But as you could imagine, with the rate of gun ownership that we have in the United States, which is by far the highest, then we find ourselves in a situation where we need to implement better policies, better strategies, better prevention efforts to reduce the risk of misuse of those firearms or either injury, causing injury or crime.
Are any of the other countries that are in that cluster of high gun violence rate countries as wealthy as the United States?
They are not. No, none of them. None of them is as wealthy as the United States. We in among high income countries around the world, we are a clear outlier when it comes to firearm mortality. I'm so glad you asked this, because let me just add one more point here, is that when we think about the overall rate of violence and different forms of violence, and we compare United States with other high income countries, we're actually not on top of the list. We're sort of in the middle of the pack. But when it comes to lethal violence, the violence that kills, when we talk about firearm-related violence, by far, the United States is an outlier compared to many other high-income countries.
The textbook chapter that you wrote really looks at gun violence as something that can be diagnosed like a disease. There are risk factors, essentially, that show higher likelihoods of experiencing either injury or death. What did your research find were those biggest risk factors?
In the handbook, we break down what we call determinants or risk factors for gun violence into different levels, looking at individual levels, peer, family, and relationship levels, community levels, and societal. And there are a couple of cross-cutting risk factors and protective factors, and ones that are unique to each level. So cross-cutting, as Ali mentioned, firearm access is a big risk factor for involvement in violence and use of firearm violence. At the sort of peer and family and relationship level, Risk factors include exposure to violence, growing up in a household where there's domestic violence, for example, being exposed in one's community to high rates of violence, community violence, and firearm violence in particular. Also, inequities in social conditions and policies that result in concentrated socioeconomic disadvantage, income inequality and poverty, segregation, and a host of concentrated risk factors that come with those conditions. At the societal level, there's also broadly norms and culture that likely contributes in some way, either directly or indirectly.
The Second Amendment, of course, is a huge part of America's identity, and it's something that you link to gun culture in the chapter. How much does that culture in the United States play into the pervasiveness of gun violence?
So that's a really important foundational question. It's part of our Constitution, it's part of our culture, and many of, you know, many friends, colleagues, people we know, many of them may have grown up in families or environments where they grew up with firearms. And so from the historic perspective, the role that firearms have had in this country is something that is you can't really deny. The point here is how we could reduce the risk of harm, including injury and crime, by smart policies and strategies that reduce that risk or misuse of them. We, by some of the best estimates, have anywhere between 350 to 400 million firearms in civilian use here in this country. 350 to 400 million firearms in this country. This is something to have in mind whenever we think about strategies for prevention, whenever we think about strategies to save lives, to prevent injuries, to prevent crime, to prevent theft of those firearms, because there are so many of them.
I know that there's an overlapping set of issues when it comes to what we might label gun culture. There's availability, there's media, there's social norms, family ties, and the prevalence of how popular guns are and how normalized they are differs across communities in the United States. Is there any research into different parts of the United States and the different ways that they treat guns and the connection to violence?
Let me highlight one example for you, which might be interesting for you and for your listeners. In terms of state levels of household gun ownership, some of the best estimates, some of the most robust estimates come from RAND Corporation. RAND has produced the estimates at the state level for household gun ownership in the United States by state. The neighboring states here in Washington, Alaska, Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, they are the top four states in the nation in terms of gun ownership, right here in Pacific Northwest. And so close to us, that is. So the reason I mentioned that is that people also may have some perceived notions about where in the country gun culture might be clustered, where it may not. It varies. And we should really have, we should pay attention to those differences. Because guns are used for a variety of different purposes in different parts of this country. And so where you think about South might be very different when you think about, let's say, Northwest of the country. I think that that part of cultural sensitivity is really important for everything we do. We are conducting a research study right now. It's ongoing to understand the cultural aspects of firearm-related behavior and handgun carrying in the rural areas in Washington. That's pretty important because it's important to hear from individuals who live in rural areas what the role of firearms is in those areas. We know that firearm-related mortalities actually has a higher burden in rural areas than it has in urban areas. Recent just came out last week in JAMA Network highlighting that. So it's something that I want to appreciate in your question that affects all of us directly or indirectly, regardless of our gender, our race, the urbanicity of our residents. It affects us differently, not the same, but it does affect all of us directly or indirectly.
When we think about states like Idaho or Wyoming or Montana, we think about people who live, you know, with guns in a way that they use them for hunting, for protection of livestock, for different reasons than, you know, you might own like a handgun in a more urban setting, let's say. Is there a direct relationship between rates of gun ownership and the prevalence of gun violence in a community?
There is good evidence, there is really solid evidence on several aspects of that. I will just say maybe a few words and then I would love Julia to take it from there. One point I wanted to highlight in this conversation is that whenever we talk about gun violence, for many people, their mind quickly goes to assault, interpersonal violence, people killing each other. We forget sometimes that we have a huge problem of suicide in this country. And in fact, the majority of gun-related deaths, let's say here in Washington, are suicide. And that really is important because it contextualizes our conversation and a way of thinking to answer questions like the great question that you just asked, that in different cultures, different settings in this country, people may own guns for different reasons, and they may have household guns, different types of guns, long guns, handguns that they use for different purposes. But one thing doesn't change in that availability and accessibility of firearms is a risk factor for violent death especially in certain communities or in certain settings. For example, take suicide as an example. We know that loaded and unlocked firearms, when they are not safely stored, they are a big risk factor for youth suicide and also accidental shooting by young children. The evidence on that is so clear, is so robust, it's not even controversial. And the question is, so how should we go about storing firearms safely in a way that is respectful of the culture and priorities of those very individuals who live in that household, but also save lives?
You mentioned that sort of the difference between long guns and handguns, and perhaps that contributing differently to the problem. And research has shown that actually long guns are more common, more prevalent in rural areas, but they're still quite likely to be used, especially in firearm suicides. And so I think it's important to just emphasize this point that firearm violence, injury, and harm is not just a problem of assault, and looking at the problem more holistically.
How much of an impact does mental health or mental illness play into the likelihood of somebody either perpetrating or being a victim of gun violence?
So mental illness is a strong risk factor for firearm suicide. Mental illness is not, however, a necessarily strong risk factor for interpersonal firearm violence or mass shootings. So estimates suggest that about 4% of interpersonal violence is attributable to mental illness. And much more of the risk, the vast majority, is attributable to risk behaviors and personality traits or behaviors such as anger, aggression, impulsivity, and substance use. And so while these things might be correlated with mental health challenges, it's not necessarily mental illness that is the driver of interpersonal firearm violence.
I just wanted to highlight that number that Julia mentioned. I want to emphasize to make sure that the listeners pay attention to that number, because the work that Dr. Jeff Swanson of Duke University has done on this is one of the best in terms of quantification of that number. That 4%, about 4% of violent offending is attributable to severe, serious mental illness. And not just any mental illness, serious, severe mental illness. And so this is really important because it's so highly stigmatized. And as Julia mentioned, whenever there's a mass shooting, whenever there is an event that is interpersonal violence and assaulting or somebody killing somebody else, many quickly talk about mental illness. I just wanted to highlight the importance of that population level research to make it very clear that mental health does not play a major role at all in offending.
Julia, you also looked at the health impacts of social exposure to gun violence. What is social exposure and how does it affect people's health?
Absolutely. This is a really important question and a really important area for research and communication. So people can be exposed to firearm violence in a number of ways. They can personally be victimized by or involved in gun violence in some way. They can know somebody who's either at risk for being involved in firearm violence or who's actually been injured or killed. They can have also broader exposure in their social networks and in their communities, even for people that they don't personally know. And these effects have been somewhat less studied, but there's increasing attention to them. These ripple effects through entire communities and society of firearm injury, death, and related harms. And these include direct health impacts, physical, mental, economic impacts on individuals and communities, and investment and residential choice, for example, and also perceptions of safety and folks' trust in one another and what we call sort of collective efficacy or feelings of safety and belonging.
Yeah. And you talk about weakening ties in a community, a lack of trust, economic growth can be hindered. There's structural problems in the neighborhoods that are just reinforced. And you talk about the cycle that just continues it and worsens it. It's really, I think, surprising for somebody like myself who doesn't look at this all the time to see those broader impacts coalesced and talked about all at once like this. Let's talk about solutions to curb gun violence and its impacts in a community. What kinds of measures were shown to be effective at curbing gun violence, Ali?
So let's talk about solutions because, you know, this is something that people always ask. And I say I share some thoughts and then would love to also hear from Julia on this. There is a social ecologic model that we talk about in chapter as well. And we built the chapter based on the social ecologic model, where you have different layers of this so-called onion, if you will, where we have, you know, the individual level, the community level, the school level, the peer level, the societal level. And so there are solutions at each layers of this multi-layer picture. You could think about individual level solutions. You could think about school-based solutions. You could think about societal big, big level solutions. And so while research on this over the years has been very, very much underfunded, and we are extremely behind, and by extremely, I mean very, very behind. We are decades behind in this line of research compared to, let's say, research on AIDS, research on cancer, research on cardiovascular mortality. By decades, we are behind. So some of the ABCs and most simple numbers we actually don't have, and people are stunned when we say we actually don't know, for example, how many people get shot and survive in this country. We don't have reliable numbers of non-fatal firearm injury in this country, and everybody is stunned.
We do not know in the United States how many people get shot and don't die.
We don't.
Just people who are affected, shot by a gun, and they survive. We don't know.
We absolutely do not know, meaning we don't have good exact numbers for that.
Why don't we know that?
Because we don't have the systems. We don't have the foundations to capture that information. It's probably a whole separate conversation on its own, in that over the years, we haven't built infrastructure and systems to be able to capture that data. The data that we have in terms of firearm-related injury that doesn't kill, that's non-fatal, at the national level come from, let's say, a sample of 100, 105, 110 hospitals. And that estimate is very unstable. We need more funding. We need more infrastructure to estimate very, very exactly how many people are harmed by firearms and they don't die. We in the field say, you know, about, we think based on some guesstimation, if you will, and based on the best mathematical gymnastics that we can do, that, you know, about for each person who dies, about two or three people get shot and do not die. That's the best we can frankly say. But we don't know exactly how many people get shot and do not die. And that's really, really important because there are many people who do not die, but they live a life with physical and mental sequela of that, and that affects not only them but also their entire communities. It's devastating, and we don't know that exact number, and many people are surprised to hear that. So going back to my earlier comment, when in the context of such dearth of information, the context of such foundational challenges in terms of our understanding of gun violence in this country, coming up with good solutions is hard because you need those building blocks to be able to come up with good solutions. If you don't know what the scope is exactly, how do you prioritize your resources to combat that problem? We need to first measure things really well to be able to then do something about them. So, having said that, there have been brilliant minds and scholars and practitioners and advocates who have been working hard to understand the scope of this and come up with some solutions. So at each of those layers that I mentioned, there are some solutions. One example would be, as I mentioned, at the individual level and household level, would be a secure storage of firearms. Secure storage of firearms can save lives, especially for young people, because we have good evidence that if guns are loaded and unlocked and available, kids can shoot each other. They can shoot also themselves and suicide. So if we lock up our guns and practice gun safety, we can save lives, at least when it comes to young children and adolescents and issues of suicide and accidental shooting. That's one example, number one. The second example, now I'm going to go very broad. Now I'm going to go at the societal level, law level. There are permit to purchase policies where they require obtaining a permit or undergoing training for individuals who are going to purchase a handgun. And those permit to purchase policies or states that have it have been shown to be associated with reduction in a whole host of different types of firearm injury, not only homicide, but also suicide, but also police-involved shootings. And so that's an example on the other end of the spectrum.
So I think when people think of solutions to the problem of gun violence, they immediately think of firearm laws and policies. And there are a number of policies that have evidence to support their effectiveness. Because of decades of lack of research funding and poor data availability and quality, a lot of the evidence is somewhat mixed. But for some policies, such as permit to purchase policies at the population level, background check policies at the individual level have been shown to be associated with reductions in violence. Certain policies like stand your ground laws and concealed carry laws have been shown to be associated with increases in violence, firearm violence.
Washington State recently banned the sale of military-style assault weapons, and Governor Inslee, I spoke to him this week, was very optimistic about its potential impact on gun violence and death in this state. Have you looked at any research when it comes to maybe the federal ban that was in place from 94 to 2004, or individual bans like in California and their impact so far? I mean, is there any research to indicate how this ban might impact violence in our state?
There is research on that. Thank you for asking because this question has come up several times. And the federal ban also is something, as you know, has been extensively discussed, both pros and cons. People who say clearly showed evidence that it worked, people are saying clearly showed evidence that did not work. So emotions run really high when we talk about that federal ban that expired. So my reaction to this, based on scientific evidence, is as the following. In terms of high capacity, large capacity magazines, we have strong evidence clearly that there is an association between those and risk of mortality, firearm-related mortality in these mass shooting events. Or the type of bans that we have on assault weapons themselves, also there is suggestion that the use of those weapons is associated with higher rates of mortality and casualties in events that are mass events or mass shooting events. So when you think about the type of, in terms of hardware, the types of firearm that these are, the type that have been banned, they can kill a lot of people in a very short period of time. And so because of that, part of the mechanics of them, and also the use of large capacity magazines in many of them, the risk of mortality in the case of mass shooting can go down when they are not in use. There's also suggestion, again, from the RAND Corporation, if you look at their website, that there's also a suggestion that maybe associated, the reduction would be associated with a reduction in the number of mass shooting events itself. And so there is clearly suggestion for potentially beneficial impact of that, especially because of, as I mentioned, the issue of fatality and the power that these types of weapons have in terms of creating physical damage.
I guess the question then on my mind is, do we have enough data? And I suppose the answer is no yet on these state level bans. And if they would behave the way the federal ban did, considering you can still bring a gun in from another state nearby that does have sale legally cleared for assault style weapons, that's just too early to tell.
I think part of this is that we definitely need more evidence and definitely need more research on it. There is no doubt about it. Let me just highlight a couple of things that you mentioned. And I think they are very, very well taken. One is the issue of other states, right? States are very porous. The borders between our states are very porous. You could have a state with restrictive gun laws just right next to their neighbor with not so strict gun laws, and then you may see not very much a difference or contrast because of the porous borders between the states. But let me also mention another example, is that these laws, for example, the assault weapon that we mentioned, it doesn't dispossess people who already have these weapons from those weapons. They already have those weapons. They can continue to have those. And so when you think about the population level impact of policies in different states, you have to consider some of these. The point that we are trying to raise here is that because of the urgency in gun violence that we are seeing in terms of its toll, in terms of its devastation for individuals, for communities, we need multi-pronged efforts to urgently save lives. Even if we could cut it by 25%, by 50%, the toll that our communities are facing, and all of us, whether it's suicide, whether it's homicide, whether it's accidental shooting. And so my point always is that there is no one magic solution. Never. I don't think there will ever be one magic solution. That's just too simplistic. But we should deploy all those tools and strategies that suggest that they could be beneficial in bringing the level of harm down at a variety of different levels. Again, it doesn't always need to be laws. I do agree with the notion that we already have several laws that we are not implementing well. They are on the books. We are not doing a good job in implementing them. I completely agree with that. I think we should do that. But also there are many other non-gun laws, as Julia mentioned, at the community level, social policy, economic policies, individual level efforts that we could deploy. It's not all just gun laws that could save lives.
Thank you both for your work. Ali Rohani and Julia Schleimer are the authors of the inaugural chapter in the Handbook of Epidemiology related to gun violence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.